නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස බුද්ධං ධම්මං සංඝං නමස්සාමි.
Highest respects to Rinpoche Pasano and Ajahn Kirinamo, Ajahn Yanako, the Sangha ordained and lay. Good afternoon and welcome. A short while ago, Ajahn Yanako asked me if I would participate in the 9 days of Dhamma that we're having, commemorating the 25th anniversary of Abhay Giri, by giving a talk in the afternoon. So despite my sabbatical and that I've been largely absent from Abhay Giri for quite a few years up at our branch monastery in the Pacific Northwest, it seemed like the least I could do to celebrate such a historic and auspicious demarcation. The thought of 25 years of Abhay Giri has occurred to me sort of over the years. Never thought it'd be quite like this in a year, quite like we've had. But that's kind of the nature of the mind. As the Buddha says, it's ever other than how we conceive of things. And one of the features that's typical for events like this too, is it comes quicker than you, quicker than you would have imagined. Just the last day or so, thinking about this gathering that's happening and 25 years of the Abhay Giri, I had a few memories kind of arise in the mind that I haven't really thought of much for a long, long time. One was when I first heard that Lumpur Pasana would be coming to California to help establish this monastery with Thanachan Amaro. And this was like probably one of the top five news events of my life. I'll never forget it. I ordained in Thailand at Wat Phananachat underneath Lumpur Pasano when he was the Jao Wat or the abbot of Wat Phananachat in those days. The idea that Lumpur would ever leave Thailand was the furthest thing from our mind. I mean, there was many things that we felt confident about and many things we had doubts about, but one thing we were sure about was Lumpur Pasano's devotion to Lumpur Cha and Dhamma Vinaya and Wapapong and just the idea that he wouldn't be in Thailand at Wat Phananachat or something never occurred to us. Despite the talks on impermanence and uncertainty, and somehow there was maybe a special category for a thought like that. I had actually been spending some time away from Wat Phananachat at the time, but there was one of the very early disciples of Lumpur Cha, Thanachan Jan, had died. And a year of preparations had been made, much along the lines of what was done for Ajahn Chah, not quite as grand on a national scale, but in the Ajahn Chah tradition, still a very large and big event. And so many monks were coming from all over the world. And I had been in a branch monastery for, I don't know, maybe 9 months or something at the time, away from Wat Phananachat. And the teacher I was living with had taken me early to help do preparations in this monastery. And since myself and maybe one other monk were the only Furong monks or Western monks there, several days preceding the beginning of the event, we were tasked with setting up the kutis for the senior Furong monks. And so we had done this, and we were on patrol awaiting the cars to arrive with Lumpur Sumedho and Tanajan Pasano and other kind of foreign abbots that were coming to the ceremonies. And we had somebody posted up near the main building, and then we were sort of waiting to sort of receive them, having been trained to be good upataks. And I'll never forget, like, finally we heard word that they had pulled up at the driveway, and the practice is to kind of be right there, and we weren't right there, so we were like trying to sort of dash up this long walkway over towards where the cars were coming. And I remember Ajahn Yatiko had Lumpur Sumedho's bags, and someone else had Lumpur's bags, and they were blasting down this path or something. And from maybe 200 yards away, Ajahn Yatiko had this surprised look on his face, and he was like, "Have you heard the news?" And his eyes were like popping out of his head or something. And I was like, "Well, what, you know?" And just as I kind of meet him and sort of grab the bags and stuff like this, he's kind of blurted out, it's like, "Ajahn Pasano's going to California. Ajahn Pasano's leaving." It truly was a big surprise. I think it was just slightly prior to that. I mean, I had heard rumors that something would happen in California. And I think maybe it was even around that same time. Ajahn Amaro was there and had talked about updates because things were about to start. I remember one meeting in particular, there was like a optional little session after tea time where Ajahn Amaro stayed around and was like showing pictures and this little map and stuff. And several of us were there or something. And Ajahn Pasano was like back in the corner, sort of like watching the whole thing. And I thought he was being very kind of skeptical, or because he had this kind of funny look on his face or something. He'd be a good poker player. I mean, you would have never known what was what was coming. Me and one of my other monk friends, we had kind of good fun sort of proliferating around what a Ajahn Chah forest monastery in California would be like. In particular, we spent many hours coming up with what we imagined California English bilingual chanting would be like. Pali English with the California vernacular. Practice would be therapeutic, and the kilesas would be your stuff. And of course, Dukkha was just heavy, man. Which, even at the time, was probably borrowing a little too heavily from the 60s for us. I remember, I think it was maybe even the next day or something, it was during that stay, I had a chance to talk to Lumpur, and my grandmother had just died around that time, and I had not visited home, although I was very newly ordained. And really my trajectory was spending as much of my life as possible studying in Thailand at the time. I was so in love with the opportunity of finding a place like the Wapapong Sangha. Although part of my mind knew that this was a little foolish, but you know, it's just like it felt like my trajectory was sort of maybe living the rest of my life out in Thailand in these monasteries. And And so I wasn't like itching to come, but also like kind of the romance of coming to start anew was a little bit enticing. And I remember talking to Ajahn Pasano or Lumpur and saying, well, you know, it would be good for me to visit my family. And if you need help, maybe I could come. And he was like, wow, there's really nothing there. I mean, there's no cooties yet. There's no, you know, and you're just ordained. I said, oh, no, I wouldn't care. I'll live under a roof, foot of a tree. I'd love to live in a tent. He said, no, it's really best for you to stay here for now and do your training as a Navaka monk. There's so many good monasteries and good teachers and so much you can learn. And it's probably some of the best advice I ever got in my life, really. I'm happy he directed me in that way. because just looking back over my monastic life, I'm really happy and fortunate to have had the chance to ordain and train in Thailand. And I think altogether I lived there a little over 6 years. When I first did come to Abhayagiri, it was just a couple years after the monastery started. And my father was sort of in poor health. And Ajahn Jayasaro, who had taken over the role of abbot after Ajahn Pasano left, suggested that it might be good for me to come spend some time here so I could be a little bit closer to my father and my family. The idea wasn't a permanent move, but just why don't you go spend some time with Lumpur Pasano. And that was in 1998. So and I think I arrived almost exactly after the two-year mark. Mm-hmm. So, and some things had happened, but still not too much. there were people still living in tents. And as excited I was to come back and live here and see what it's like to build a monastery from scratch and help with that as well, because I had an enormous sort of feeling of gratitude for what was offered in Thailand to me and my peers. You know, these monasteries that had been built and cared for and requisites adequately provided and just kind of welcomed into a foreign land by foreign people to take up the practice in a way that was so pure, in my mind, correlated even so closely to like what you read in the suttas. The simplicity of the monastery at the time in Thailand and the opportunity to live as a barefoot alms mendicant and carry an alms bowl into local villages and gather alms and very few duties so you could really devote yourself to training in Dhamma Vinaya, meditation practice. I remember just feeling what a tremendous gift that was, especially after having lived there for a few years. And the thought of helping contribute to establishing something in America for those who can't make it to Thailand. Was kind of appealing. Although even at that time, my thought was I'd just spend a little bit of time here. I still was mostly conceiving of spending the rest of my life in Thailand. Arriving, aside from this kind of romantic notion of just a barren patch of land and nothing being here, it was actually a little more dispiriting than that. It was something more akin to a Buddhist trailer park. There was like a whole field down here was full of, it looked like a refuge yard or a, like a rebuild it center or something. There was all kinds of supplies that we inherited with the land and then some that had been collected. And then there was a bunch of hand-me-down trailers and campers and tents and sheds. And we had one toilet famously for 10 years. And but just the even the initial community that was gathering at the time, the lay people and the people coming to ordain, and the quality of teachings, and like the frequency of, I'd say the availability of two very high quality, well trained monastics in Lumpur Pasino and Ajahnamra was just exceptional. Like, you know, every day had the opportunity to practice with them and formally and informally receive teachings a couple times a week. And, you know, really it's something that's kind of carried on to this day. For those who haven't spent time in other monasteries, it's quite uncommon the level of Dhamma practice that's kind of done here at Abhayagiri, and then just the frequency and the amount of kind of teachings that happen every day. And even comparing to most Thai monasteries in the Ajahn Chah tradition, you know, it's rare to get, like, you know, in the wintertime, the series of teachings that are done every day. I never really experienced anything like that in Thailand for very long. And it was quite nice to spend time here. It was kind of a difficult part of my life, and I did eventually go back to Thailand for a bit of time, and maybe about 18 months, a year or so after my father passed away. And I met up with Lumpur Pasino on one of his annual trips during that time, and I was in the middle of doing a Tudong, kind of wandering around northern Thailand. And I had the chance to pay respects to him. I think it was up in the north. He was up teaching a retreat maybe, and I had a chance to go visit him. And he was telling me about the goings-on, and there had been quite a few monks had gone off here and there to spend time in other monasteries and whatnot. And I remember saying to him, sort of like, wow, it doesn't sound like you have much help. And he says, yeah, maybe a little thin or something. And I said, well, if you ever need my help, I'd be happy to come back. And he says, okay. I mean, you mean right now? And he said, well, no, you can finish your Tudong, but maybe, you know, if you want to come back, that would be helpful. And that would have been about 2002, maybe?
You were on your Tudong when I got here.
Oh, right.
You got back after I'd been here for 7 months, so you got back in 2002.
That's right, I hadn't met Leif yet. I hadn't met Anagarika Leif. I'd heard about him, but I hadn't met him. And so, yeah, I came back around that time. And even then, I kind of thought, well, maybe I'll spend a couple of years here and a couple of years in Thailand. But I spent most of the next 12 years here and got increasingly engaged helping out with some of the monastery development. And that was difficult. I mean, 25 years on, we're still building the monastery. It's a bit like a cathedral project in medieval Europe. Something that's taking an enormous amount of patience and time and hard work and money. But at 25 years, feels mostly done. And it feels every bit as precious and beautiful as one of those cathedrals. So it's maybe been more expensive and more difficult than other monasteries, but so worth it in so many dimensions. One, it's just an amazing facility, a beautiful monastery, a wonderful community. And, you know, part of the core of the original vision for the place was to establish a place for the Sangha here in America, and for Bayagiri to be kind of like the head monastery or parent monastery of our tradition, place where people could come and seek monastic training, draw near monastics, get regular teachings. And that's all happened in just the most perfect and beautiful way. And for the time I spent here and gave to that kind of project, that's also turned out to be kind of a substantial blessing in my life. It's like certainly one of the things that I feel a great sense of merit and joy, just having been kind of part of that process. Maybe not always the most joyous part of that. It certainly came with a certain amount of sort of suffering, but you know, something that really carried me through that was just the quality of being that exists in the teachers here, and also just that thought, like, how many people will benefit from having a place like this where there wasn't such an opportunity in the world. Like, I remember when I first came across the Ajahn Chah tradition, I was in Thailand already, and I think I had like his Buddhist Handbook by John Snelling or something. It's like a British author at the time. And he had this little index of Buddhist centers in the back. And I just read one of the early books of Ajahn Sumedho and was quite impressed with it. So I was like flipping through the back of this thing, and then there was like Ajahn Sumedho and the monasteries in England were listed or something. And I got really excited, like, wow, he's from Seattle. And I grew up in Washington State as well. My mom was from that area. And I thought, wow, that's really exciting. And then I was like looking at the list of all the monasteries, and almost all of them were in Europe, except one in New Zealand. And most of them were England. And I thought, well, what good's that? I'm not going to go all the way to England to live with some guy from Seattle to practice Thai Buddhism. especially since I'm here in Thailand already. And so I ended up shortly after that sort of writing Wat Nanachat and then heading up to Wat Nanachat, which is where I ended up ordaining. So just the kind of thought, both when I was in Thailand, so many times when the weather was too hot, or when you were experiencing less than perfect conditions, you know, even the Thai notion of what constitutes a forest contrasts starkly with my sense of it growing up in the Pacific Northwest. And I would also oftentimes think, God, it'd be a lot nicer to be in a forest in America. There's a lot less disease, there's a lot less noise, there's a lot less creepy, crawly, poisonous things. But at the time, nothing like that existed. And now it does. And not just this monastery, but we have Temple Monastery as another kind of main training center in America. Those two monasteries run pretty close to full, and have since their inception. But, you know, at least we have this, and there has been now almost over a generation of monks coming to these monasteries and entering the Sangha, and many have stayed, some haven't, some have moved on to different things. And we still have our first homegrown monk, Ajahn Kirtidhammo, who was freshly minted when I arrived in 1998. I think his ordination was maybe like 2 weeks before I came. Visakha Puja, 1998. So they had just had their first ordination. And he was... the monastics were in the minority those days. It's more lay people than monks. And then when I came back from Thailand in 2002, Anakarika Leaf was probably Samanera Yanako already.
Not quite. I think like maybe 3 months after you got back.
Yeah. And one of the things I did when I was here, I was pretty big on the idea that we needed to have a more of a presence on the internet. And Ajahn Yanako is what I refer to as our first internet monk. if I remember the story right, he was interested in Buddhism and his dad was aware of Ajahn Chah's teaching, who's here today. And he said, oh, if you're interested in Buddhism, you got to read this. And gave him a book of Ajahn Chah's.
Still Forest Pool.
Yeah. Still Forest Pool. And then he was thinking he was going to have to go to Thailand and got online to sort of find some information and was surprised to find that there was a monastery here in California. And having been raised on the Big Sur coast, in the grander scheme of things, that's still pretty close to your home for a Buddhist monastery in the West.
I believe it was designed by Kondanya.
The original one was, yeah.
And that was the original.
Oh, it was.
Like, yeah. A picture of four monks walking.
Oh, the four monks at Bell Springs. Yeah. Yeah. It was classic. So. So, yeah, 25 years of Abhayagiri. We're still not finished. And in some sense, monasteries kind of never are. But it's kind of off to a good start. And the first generation has been a kind of grand project, very successful. And it's kind of interesting timing with it coming sort of at the end of this kind of year of 100-year pandemic and a whole new kind of phase also with Lumpur Pasano sort of stepping back. We're not just here at Abhayagiri, but in many of our sanghas, we now have a preponderance of elder experienced monks. And we're kind of entering a whole new phase of trying to learn how to build intergenerational monasteries. It's kind of exciting to see happening and fun to be part of that experiment, and amazing to see someone like Ajahn Yanako, who started out here, sort of now taking on the leadership role, out running the monastery and taking responsibility for training all the new candidates that come here for ordination. So, it's kind of a mark of, kind of a further development of the monastery really taking roots in America. And I remember a long time ago, maybe I think it was Lumpur Pasano was sharing some anecdote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama about when will you know that the Dhamma has really arrived in a new land or something. Mm-hmm. And one of the comments that he made was like when the Sangha is kind of established, and I forget exactly how he put it, but kind of more... in a more indigenous way, you know, rather than monks like Lumpur or even me who trained somewhere else, ordained somewhere else, and then came here. And the majority of the community now has ordained here under Lumbarpasano and Ajahn Amaro and now Ajahn Yanako. And it's pretty much homegrown. In fact, I think when I came, Ajahn Kunadamo was the only American monk here. And now even Ajahn Pasano is an American monk. Although he still has his Canadian passport. So these are a few kind of thoughts and sharings and stories on this occasion. And often thinking about this monastery and what a rare gift it is, wish to remind all of us, myself included, as well as everyone gathered, just what a rare and precious thing it is. And part of what keeps it that is our dedication and integrity to really making use of it. Like one of my favorite things to reflect on is Buddha said, if you really want to pay homage to me, do the practice. And I think Ajahn Chah sort of at one point said something just along the same lines. Aside from all the buildings and everything that goes on and the events and the ups and downs, the core of what we're here for is to learn about Buddha Dhamma and cultivate the good and learn how to understand and transcend the dukkha that is so possible to do. Maybe not easy, maybe not so straightforward, maybe a great project like building a monastery that takes a great amount of time, but something that is possible. The Buddha's teachings are squarely aimed at the dukkha in our lives that is optional, that can be understood, and the causes and conditions for letting go of that and ceasing the habits of suffering can be developed and realized for the benefit of self and others. And I think that's very much alive here in the Sangha, both the monastic Sangha and the lay Sangha that practices and lives and gathers here. And as we kind of mark the first chapter of this kind of great story, let us kind of reflect on that and rededicate ourselves to everything that entails. I thank Lumbar and Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Kunadamo and present Sangha, the past Sangha, and the Sangha yet to come.
Sadhu Karangadamase Sadhu.